This is Amber Ray.
And Rusty Tanton.
And you're listening to Mostly ITP on the Georgia Podcast Network, the show focused on all things Atlanta and sometimes elsewhere.
This past weekend, I interviewed Bobby Blackwolf, host of The Bobby Blackwolf Show, for our Meet Your Affiliates series. The interview took place at Manuel's Tavern on June 28, 2008. If you get a pair of podcasters going, the discussion could go on for quite a while. This one went on for about an hour, so the interview will be split up into two podcasts. Here's the first part, where we discuss his show, the Nintendo Wii, and our shared esteem for Super Mario Bros. 2, among other topics. Enjoy!
Why don't you tell us a little bit, first of all, Bobby, about how you started your show, what it's about, everything like that.
Okay, well, the show that I do, it's called The Bobby Blackwolf Show, because I am egotistical, and I don't want anybody to replace me. So it's The Bobby Blackwolf Show. Basically, we talk about video games, the latest news that's affecting the video game industry. We sometimes talk about video game history and stuff, but basically trying to look at like a more mature, serious take on things that are occurring in the industry and not just, oh, the graphics in this game are sick, you know, and things like that. I do it on All Games Radio, which is owned by a man by the name of Scott Rubin, who some people may recognize as one of the founders of the G4 television network, but people earlier may recognize him as one of the founders of the All Games Network, which was with Pseudo Online Entertainment. Pseudo did what we now call video podcasts, but they did them in the late 90s, from like 1997 to 2000. They were trying to rival CNN and do video-based. They were doing live video. They did something from, like, the Democratic National Convention in 2000. They had this 365-degree camera. Well, he was with them. And he actually produced a live one-hour daily video show about video games, which you could then watch offline, or you could interact live with a chat room, interact live with them, call them up and stuff. And I started watching his stuff in 1997. From my dorm room in UGA, and you know, he was on from 4 o'clock, from 4 to 5 and stuff, and I kind of just stuck with him. And when he moved through to G4, I kind of followed him over there. He was one of the hosts of G4TV.com, one of their shows, which is the same kind of format but not live. And then when Comcast bought Tech TV, he was a big fan of Tech TV and didn't like what they were doing to Tech TV, and so he said, see ya. Bye, I'm out of here. And he revived allgames.com, and I happened to be there, right place, right time, and I said, you know, I want to try to do some of the live radio. And I actually did a little bit in 2004, right when podcasting, like the first people were figuring out podcasting, and people asked me, oh, so it's a podcast? I'm like, no, it's a live, we were on Live 365. I'm like, no, it's just live internet radio. I provide an MP3 archive of the show that you can download, but it wasn't a podcast.
Yeah.
Then iTunes integrated podcasting in June of 05, and I said, I want to do this, because we had canceled our Live 365 account at that point. We kind of weren't doing anything, just trying to build up the site. Scott was working on some television projects that he wanted to do. And so I said, well, I'm going to do this, and I want to do it live. I'm going to go buy a Live 365 account. And Scott Rubin's like, no, wait, I will buy a Shoutcast station, so that's what, you know, for Shoutcast MP3. And you can use that instead of you buying a Live 365 account. That way he could do it. And so in July of 2005, on a Sunday night at 8 p.m., I started talking about video games. And we actually had a kind of a little bit of an audience, maybe 10 or 15 people, basically because of the name recognition of All Games and the community we had. And I've pretty much been doing it ever since. I missed 1 week last month. But I've done 152 straight weeks.
That's a pretty amazing streak.
I think it's 147 is when I stopped and just missed that 1 week.
Yeah, but I mean, there was some stuff going on.
Yeah, we'll get to that.
Yeah, we'll get to that.
But essentially, I wanted to have my voice. I had stuff to say.
Yeah.
And so I'm like, I'm going to take an hour and say that stuff, and then I'm also going to let people call in and say their stuff. So basically, the show it's a live internet radio show, which in the beginning meant I wasn't a podcaster. In fact, I was kind of told, no, you're not allowed to run in these podcast circles, even though what you hear on my podcast is not the same that you will hear live, because I do go through and I edit it, because there are things that happen. I'm reading through a chat room, so you can interact live in the chat room, and sometimes I have to actually stop and look through the chat room because I want to find the intelligent comments and read them, because never underestimate the power of reading someone's name on the air. They love that.
Oh, yeah.
They love
absolutely.
That. So, they, you know, they have the little game of how many times can we get our comment read. So they say some really neat stuff and, you know, trying to get it in. So, so I did the live show, and we've pretty much, I get maybe 40 to 50 listeners live a week. All interacting, all in the chat room, sometimes having their own conversations.
I usually catch the show as a podcast after the fact. Sunday nights typically aren't like the greatest time, but I actually did check into the show last week and was just kind of watching everything that went on in the chat room. I mean, it was really active and lively and vibrant, really kind of amazing. I was paying attention almost solely to that, and I still couldn't follow it all half of the time.
There's a trick. Like when I'm talking, I'm not looking at chat. I actually have it on a separate computer to my right, and I've got my little plan of what I'm going to do, my plan of attack, which basically I gather headlines and some quotes from whatever article. And I don't look at chat because they will try to distract you. They want you to be distracted. And some of our callers, because we do actually, we have a toll-free number, so people don't have to, I mean, we have Skype as well, which actually has better sound quality, but we use Vonage and have a toll-free number in the U.S. so people can just pick up their phone and call in. And they get distracted by chat, and I'm like, dude, don't look at chat.
Yeah.
Just promise me, because they will tear you apart. And in fact, when we have live guests, like live interviews, I kind of tell them, you know, you probably don't want to look into chat, because a lot of times, you know, some of the guests that I have, or, you know, some the chatters may find boring. Like, it would be great for a podcast audience. You know, it's very interesting for a podcasting audience. But the chatters are like, get this guy off the phone, go to something else, you know, and making fun of him. So, it's quite an experience, and frankly, I don't know how you guys do it pre-recorded without a live audience reacting to you. I've done it a couple times where I've tried to, like, I've had to, when I do, like, Dragon Con, I'll put in the Dragon Con panel I'm on, and I'll do, like, an intro from the hotel room, just me with the mic, and I'm doing, like, five or six takes of it just because I'm like, oh, but it's pre-recorded. It's got to be perfect.
Well, you know? we kind of take the attitude with it. I want to get the first 10 or 20 seconds done really well.
Right.
You know, the sort of intro, the hook in. And then after that, we kind of just let it fly. We might do a retake of the intro.
Yeah.
But after that, not so much. Yeah. I don't know. We've been experimenting with live podcasting recently, and you know, I really want to do more of those. I want to do at least one or two a month because it's a lot of fun, even just having a couple of callers come in. We obviously haven't gotten anywhere near the audience that you've picked up yet, but that comes with doing it all the time.
Yes.
How did you get into video games to begin with?
My brother, who's 14 years older than I am, he made the purchasing decisions in the family when I was very, very young, and he convinced my parents to buy him an Intellivision back in the early 80s, because George Plimpton was on the TV with the Atari 2600 on one side and the Intellivision on the other side, and saying, which one looks more like the real thing? And that was the Intellivision. And so we actually had an Intellivision. And my dad worked for the phone company, which in the 70s only meant one thing. But it became Bell South, is where he eventually retired. So he was into computers. He was an electrical engineering person. So we had a VIC-20 and a Commodore 64. I would not be surprised if he had an old Altair somewhere. He built, like, the old Heathkit TVs. Our TVs were the ones that he built.
My dad built those.
So I grew up around computers. Yeah. I wrote my first program in BASIC when I was four on a Commodore 64. Print and input and print and input.
Mm-hmm.
It was a question and answer thing with Sesame Street. I actually found it later, and the spelling was horrible. Whatever you typed in the input had absolutely no bearing on what came in the program. But it was a program, and
like,
it was about...
I wrote a program.
And it was about 50 lines, and I was like, and I was four, and it was awesome. So I got started, you know, really early with computers and playing computer games on Commodore 64 and stuff, and, you know, eventually did convince my parents when the Power Pad came out to get the Nintendo NES for me. And I just enjoyed playing them. I'm not really particularly very good at them, but I enjoyed playing them. And then when I got into college, doing the computer science major, and I actually started trying to write some games using DirectX. And then basically I got more into it from watching Game Time on All Games Network and stuff. And that when E3 came to Atlanta for 2 years, E3 is the Electronic Entertainment Expo. It was the big trade show of the video game industry. And I actually got into those in 97 and 98 down at the Georgia World Congress Center. And I was like, I want to be a part of this. And so when I graduated and actually got a real job where I could afford things, I started getting, you know, all the consoles. And I even tried to get some back consoles. I have 11 game consoles hooked up to my TV. At a flip of maybe 2 or 3 switches, I can turn any of them on. And, you know,
it's pretty impressive.
Play all those. So it's just, it really stuck with me. And, you know, that's what I'm passionate about. Whenever you hear anybody talking about, you know, podcasting, you got to podcast your passion. Well, you know, it's a no-brainer for me. That's what it is. So I'm kind of, you know, working on doing some game development and stuff, you know, working with XNA, which is Microsoft's, using C#, but it's their initiative to get, you know, homebrew or independent developers to code for.
I actually downloaded some of the early beta stuff they had a few months ago.
Right.
That was kind of fun.
Yeah.
How easy is it to, for somebody who's already been programming, to throw one of those games together? I mean, what's the kind of overhead involved?
Well, it depends on what you're using.
Yeah.
Okay, like if it's DirectX, which is basically what a lot of the Windows games use, or even OpenGL for Linux and stuff, you've got to know a lot of math just to get like a cube, a 3D cube on the screen and stuff. You've got to know exactly how to code your transformation matrices and, you know, all that stuff. XNA, I had a full modeled spaceship flying around on the screen in about 2 hours. In full,
that, 720p, that a user could actually control
with the controller, with the Xbox 360 controller, with vibration. So like the engine, it would vibrate the controller 2 hours. And, you know, I mean, I've known C++, and C#'s not really that much different from like C++ and stuff. XNA makes it super, super simple to get into it, and it also works on PC. And you can actually plug in a wired Xbox 360 controller into your PC and test that way. And
so now, I would imagine the downside to that is you're not going to get nearly the performance out of those games that you're going to get out of actually doing it with DirectX.
Right. And that's why a lot of companies will use XNA for prototyping. Because they can whip up a prototype of a game in a couple days and then transfer what they can and then work on the real game engine underneath and stuff. Now, with XNA, you have to know how to program to do it. There are other solutions like the Torque game engine from Garage Games, which actually does work in XNA. They've made it in XNA. But that's more of your drag and drop. You can actually design things without coding. And you can actually build full side-scrollers or even first-person shooters.
I've noticed even on the Xbox 360, like Saints Row, it uses, I don't remember what the name of the engine is.
But Unreal Engine?
I don't think it's the Unreal Engine. Yeah. It's a different one. I don't remember it. But anyway, it seems like a lot of these companies have gotten into the business of selling the engines to their games. ID Software, I know, obviously has been selling Quake 3 Engine, and Unreal with theirs, and a couple of others. Is that more profitable than making games, or?
It depends on the company.
Yeah.
Like ID Software, I think their games aren't that great. You know, like Doom 3 wasn't all that it was cracked up to be, but that engine was great. And what I said is, I looked at Doom 3 and I'm like, yeah, this game is horrible, but I can't wait to see what other companies will do with this engine.
Like the most glorified technology demo ever.
Exactly. So for like maybe ID Software, licensing out their engine is a lot better. Epic, Gears of War, which was their latest one, that's, you know, sold hotcakes. And Gears of War 2 is coming out this holiday season. That's going to do real well. And on top of that, they have just about everybody and their mother using their engine.
Yeah.
So I think it's both.
Now, we've talked about a lot of shooter games like Gears of War, you know, Unreal Tournament, Quake 3, all that. I know from listening to your show, you're not a big fan of shooters.
Right.
Why?
Because I suck at them.
That'll do it.
Seriously, I'm pretty much that's what it is.
Yeah.
It's not that I'm not a fan of them. I don't enjoy them. And you'll kind of always hear me say, I didn't enjoy it. I never say it's a bad game. I didn't enjoy Gears of War. I think it's a spectacular game.
Yeah. Okay.
It looks beautiful, plays beautifully. I just suck at it, and so I don't enjoy playing it.
Yeah.
So, you know, Doom 3 I actually thought was a bad game.
Yeah.
And I sucked at it. But Doom 3 I didn't think was all that good. But I can, like, see that, like, Halo 3 and Gears of War and, you know, even Resistance, Fall of Man on the PlayStation 3, those are really good games. I just don't enjoy playing them, and so I won't. Same with, I don't enjoy stealth games, and the big game that came out this month for the PlayStation 3 is Metal Gear Solid 4. I'm not going to buy it. I'm positive it's a very well-made game, and it's great. I just don't enjoy playing stealth games. And no matter how many CPUs you throw at me, how many iterations of the cell processor, it's not going to make me enjoy a style of gameplay I don't like.
How do you approach trying to explain what's good about one of those games as somebody who can't necessarily enjoy it all that much yourself?
Well, I can kind of look past my enjoyment, and I like listen to other people because, like, I have the full community at all games, and a lot of times, like when Metal Gear Solid 4 came out, I didn't say anything about it. I said, "Hey, I want one of my callers to call in," and luckily, I had a very big Metal Gear Solid and PlayStation 3 fanboy call in who had already completed the game, and this is the week it came out, and he basically went through and said, "You know, this is why it's great," and so I'll just refer to that, you know, as to why, you know. It's got a very good, deep story that will make you cry and stuff. Yeah, it's a little convoluted and stuff, you know. You might not know everything that's going on, but it's very well made, very well told. And, you know, the graphics are great. I mean, I can see that the graphics are great in a game and stuff. And you know, sometimes I will have fun. Like, in Halo 3, I did have fun playing it. I just wasn't going to play it every day.
Yeah. I'm kind of the same way with most shooters. My friends are big Halo 3 fans, and I just could never get into it.
Yeah.
I don't know. Halo, to me, kind of seems like what I was playing in my dorm room 10 years ago. I mean, you know, we were playing Quake 2 and the Terminator game and all this other things.
Right.
And it seems like the same game.
Yeah.
I don't know. But it is interesting that that's just moved out to consoles now. And I don't know, the sort of PC experience that I was having in college,
right. People
can have it now on the consoles.
And a lot of people prefer to have it on consoles, too. And, you know, Nintendo really hit it on the head. People like playing games in the same room.
Yeah.
And I've actually been noticing, you know, people who've listened to my show would know that I've been upset that there are games out there that don't have split-screen multiplayer or don't have the way for two people to sit on the couch to play against each other. They only do it online. Recent games, MotorStorm on the PlayStation 3 or Burnout Paradise, which came out recently on the Xbox 360 and PlayStation 3, there is no way to play against my girlfriend who lives with me. You know, we can't play at the same time. You know, or a friend of mine comes over, and if we want to play Burnout Paradise together, I have to tell him, go back to your house and get online. You know, we can't sit there. But with the Wii, you know, we're able to play Smash Brothers or Mario Kart in the same room. And it's a fun experience, and a lot of companies are saying online's where it's at, you got to have an online mode. And I say, no. You know, there are some games that are more fun when you can sit next to the other guy and give him a dirty look when he knocks you off the track or knocks you off the stage or, you know, runs you off the road or whatever.
Do you hear a lot of people on your show sort of scoffing at the Wii?
Yes. A lot of people, because my show, you know, a lot of the hardcore audience that listen to my show are the types that have high-definition televisions that are into your big games like the Metal Gear Solids and, you know, the Grand Theft Autos and things like that. And the Wii, they see as a gimmick, and they don't they don't like how it's survived past its gimmick with everybody else. And they kind of begrudge Nintendo for kind of ignoring them, which they kind of have. Because they've noticed that minigame compilations sell like hotcakes.
Yeah.
And, you know, the good, innovative games are not doing too well. And actually, I was looking at sales numbers on the DS recently, their handheld system. And a great game that came out that I really enjoyed, it was a rhythm action game. It was called Elite Beat Agents. And it's basically you're tapping areas of the DS screen with the stylus to the beat of the music. And it's actually got some, you know, big name acts. It's the only time I'll ever listen to an Ashley Simpson song. Actually works really well. There's a Madonna song in there too. And I looked, and it sold like 190,000 copies total, okay? Another, and I can't remember which company made these, but it's a series of DS games called Imagine, okay? And it's basically, they've got Imagine Cooking, Imagine Stuff, and Imagine Babies is one of them, and it's kind of like, you know, a virtual baby type of thing. And we're like, wow, that's going to tank. You wonder how many copies that sold? 1.93 million.
That's a lot of copies.
Of Imagine Babies. Whereas an innovative new game like Elite Beat Agents sells 180,000 worldwide. Yeah. These are worldwide numbers we're looking at.
Well, that's sort of a number you run into with the movie industry, with books. I mean, you see John Grisham books. Mm-hmm. They sell a lot of schlock.
Yeah.
Movies. Any crappy romantic comedy will do $150 million.
Yeah. And I mean, people are seeing, you know, like, even in the video game area, you know, the video game based on the movie Cars, mm-hmm. not that great of a game, mm-hmm. was always in the top 10 of sales. Mm-hmm. You know, people were just eating that up.
Yeah.
You know, those games really do well, and there's a lot of people that like them, even if they're not all that great of a game. You know. So, well, yeah, people do scoff at the Wii, which I think has a lot of good software. I like a lot of the software that's mm-hmm. on the Wii, but it's not all Metal Gear Solids, and it's mm-hmm. not all Halos, and so people scoff at it.
I mean, from a technological standpoint, it's just kind of like a beefed-up GameCube, isn't it? You know, I mean, it's just got a slightly faster processor.
And you know, the genius of that, which a lot of people don't understand, is that, yes, it's running the GameCube architecture. So companies making games for the Wii already have 6 years of knowledge from the GameCube to work on the Wii. So the Wii is actually able to hit its potential sooner in its life cycle.
Well, not to mention Nintendo was profiting from day one on every single one of them that sold. Whereas something, maybe you could explain, a common thing in the video game industry is for companies to take a hit on consoles early on.
It's the razor and blade analogy, you know. They, you know, Bic loses money on the razors, but they make money gouging you on the blades.
Yeah.
It's the same way with the consoles. They maybe will take a $50 hit on a console. I know PlayStation 3, it was like somewhere between $1,500 $1,500 when it first came out. That's how much of a loss they took on each console. But they hope that you would buy accessories, the remote control, extra controllers, games, things like cables.
Yeah.
You know, they didn't include an HDMI cable in the hopes that you would buy your own HDMI cable. Preferably their HDMI cable that costs twice as much as everybody else. Nintendo doesn't do that. Nintendo's in this to make money. And so they were making about $35, $40 on every Wii, and same on the DS. And they were going to have enough product in stores, so they thought. And it was kind of funny because the PlayStation 3 came out 2 days before the Wii did, in November. And the big story was the PlayStation 3. Why? eBay. In all the lines that I went to, because I went around to several lines, I would say, there was a shortage, so there was maybe only 6 people in line or 10 people in line. I would say 80 or 90% of them were not going to open their PS3.
Yeah.
It was going straight to eBay.
I knew people who did that.
Okay. And they got owned because nobody bought the PlayStation 3 after the first week. And so a lot of people were returning PS3s back to the store because they got more money that way than they would have on eBay. Because nobody in their right mind was going to buy it on eBay when they could just walk into the store and pay market price for it and have it in hand right then. And I would ask them, like, so are you going to do this for the Wii? No, that's a waste of time. There's going to be so many on the market. It's not a powerful system. They started all kicking themselves. You still can't find a Wii in stores today.
Yeah.
And it was released in November of 2006.
I've seen them on Amazon from, like, the third-party Amazon resellers for up to, like, $600, $700, something like that, for this little GameCube, basically.
Right. You know, it's a lot of people say it's two GameCubes duct-taped together.
Yeah.
And with a waggle controller.
Yeah.
And that's really all the Wii is, but people are enjoying it and loving it.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, people are saying, well, why didn't they release the waggle controller for the GameCube and just leave it like that? They wouldn't have gotten the penetration, because nobody's going to go out and buy a waggle controller and a GameCube.
Yeah.
It was the fact that it was all packaged in with Wii Sports.
Yeah.
And a lot of people, it's just a Wii Sports player. They'll never take that disc out of the Wii.
Yeah.
Which is not a good thing for third parties.
But Wii Sports is a hell of a lot of fun.
It is.
We spent probably 4 or 5 hours just playing that at a party the other night,
And it's just a tech demo.
Yeah.
That's just a tech demo. And right now, Wii Fit,
yeah,
you can't find anywhere.
Yeah.
You cannot get Wii Fit. Basically, all Wii Fit is, it's a balance board. You might have seen it on TV.
Yeah.
But it's basically, it's got four scales duct taped together inside it. That's my joke about it. But it's four scales, and you can actually stand on this, and basically the four scales are, you can't see my hands, obviously, because this is radio. But it's kind of in a grid, like, yeah, you know, a 2x2 grid. And they can detect your weight and your balance. And there are games, like, there are parts of it, like, it, you do yoga and some other, you know, aerobics and stuff, and it will track your BMI, which has gotten in trouble, because it'll call kids fat that aren't fat, because it can't really, it can't accurately detect the BMI of kids. And there are also other games, like there's a game kind of like, it's kind of like Marble Madness, if you know that game, or Super Monkey Ball, if you, if you're more recent, where you have a little marble and you're you have to tilt the world to put the marble in the hole, and that actually uses your feet. Using your feet to do that, and there's like a soccer headbutting game where you actually have to headbutt, and it can actually detect where what your thing is. It's amazing technology, expensive, sold out everywhere. You cannot get it.
Now, how often with console selling out or with games selling out, are they trying to manufacture these things at full capacity and they just can't do it, versus staggering the manufacturing to try to drum up news stories, try to drum up excitement?
It depends.
Yeah.
It really depends on what's coming up. A lot of times it's not the manufacturing, it's the retail stores. I have heard a story of a Best Buy, I think it was in New Jersey, a guy was in a Best Buy, and he was just kind of looking around, and out comes this employee from the back holding a Wii above his head, saying, "We just got the last Wii off the truck," screaming it through the aisles. Some couple runs up, immediately buys it. Okay? The guy's still in the store. 30 minutes later, guy comes out, "We just got the last Wii off the truck." And they had maybe 10 or 15 or 20 in the back that they would just bring out one at a time and say, "This is the last one." And so the stores will do that, or they'll stockpile if there's going to be a big game coming out, like when Super Smash Brothers or Wii Fit came out. They would stockpile Wiis in the back room and then bring them out.
Few at a time. Yeah.
Right. Or when the game comes out, when people buy the game, they can buy the system. And that way they kind of were guaranteed. And sometimes, like, if you see an ad in a circular about, you know, if you see a Wii in the ad, they have to, by law, actually have some of the product in stock for that Sunday morning. Which is actually what some people did at the launch of the Wii. They did a midnight launch, but they had to withhold 10 to 12 because they had an ad in the Sunday paper saying they would have Wii, so they could not sell them all. And so a lot of times that'll happen.
I still frequently find, or I used to find when I actually bothered with those Sunday morning ads, that they would be sold out by the time I got there.
Right.
And I might get there like half an hour after the place opened.
Right.
But it would still be sold out.
Yeah, but like with the Wii, people would have sat outside 6 to 12 months after launch.
Yeah.
It would be like another launch day. You know, Best Buy has 30 Wiis, let's all go and camp out.
I really regret, I ran into a stock of Wiis at a BrandSmart, like right after it came out, and there were like six of them sitting there, and I could have picked up six of them and probably flipped them for three times what I paid for them in the store.
Even today, like even I consider that if I see a Wii on a shelf, I may buy it and just flip it on eBay.
Yeah.
Because they're still going.
That's amazing to me. I mean, like I said, I mean, do you think they are making them as quickly as they can make them?
Well, see, I know that they're making 1.3 million a month. Mm-hmm. That's kind of their numbers that they're releasing to their
shareholders. That's a lot of Wiis, too.
They're selling 1.3 million a month.
Yeah.
Okay? I mean, they are selling how much they're producing.
Yeah.
And 1.3 million, and that's worldwide.
Yeah.
So it's probably staggered, you know, depending. Sometimes they'll send more to the UK. Sometimes they'll send more to the US. It depends. So they probably could make more, but they're getting still, people are going to buy them. They're going to wait for it.
Yeah.
You know. Now, Nintendo has been known in the past of, you know, doing manufacturing a shortage. They've been known to do that in the past, and they might have done it. They obviously always denied it. They might have done it earlier. I don't think they're doing it anymore. I think that they're really trying to keep up with
the demand.
And they're not. They just physically can't. I mean, 1.3 is a lot.
Yeah. I mean, it seems like that might be something to do short term, right when something launches. But you wouldn't want to do that for any length of time.
Yeah.
I remember when Super Mario Brothers 3 came out. People freaked out about that. It was like a minor miracle that I got a copy for Christmas that year.
Super Mario 2 was mine.
Yeah.
And my parents actually tell the story because it was on my Christmas list, and they tried to get that game a lot. You know, they tried.
Yeah.
And it wound up, my dad apparently was in a Toys R Us, and they just got a shipment in. And he almost got trampled by little old ladies trying to get me Super Mario 2. And they were so proud when they did actually get it. And the way that they packaged it was, there was this one big box. And they actually put like a lot of that like Easter, like the kind of fluffing you put like an Easter basket, you know, okay? And they put the game at the bottom of that box, put a whole bunch of like fluffing on it, and put like some clothes on the top. And stuff, and that was my last present, and I'm like, oh, it's a shirt.
That's a shirt.
Wonderful,
thanks.
Thank you. And I put the button, and they're like, you're not going to dig? And so I'm like, and I keep digging, and it's all the way down at the bottom, and there's Super Mario 2. So that was my parents' launch story, and they just, it was a miracle. It was like the 23rd is when they got it, of December, and they had been looking since it came out, trying to get this.
Super Mario 2 gets kind of a bad rap because it's such a departure from some of the conventions of the Mario series.
Well, it wasn't a Mario game.
Yeah, because it was originally a Japanese game.
It was like a Japanese game series. Called Doki Doki Panic.
Yeah.
And essentially, the real Super Mario Brothers 2, which is, actually you can get it now, it's called The Lost Levels. Mm-hmm. It's actually on the Wii Virtual Console. It was considered too difficult for American audiences. A lot of the early games were dumbed down in their U.S. release. A lot of early games. They took out the hard parts of it. And Super Mario, the real Super Mario 2, was sadistic. The first mushroom you came up against was a poison mushroom. It killed you when you touched it. And so if you play Super Mario 2...
That's your introduction to Super Mario 2.
Yeah. And so, and they actually released our Super Mario 2 as Super Mario USA. But it was really just Doki Doki Panic, and even, you know, a lot of the enemies they even kept the same. They just slapped Mario and Luigi and the Princess and Toad on it and sold it here, and it sold really well.
Which I really liked it, by the way.
Yeah.
I mean,
it's
I,
not
I know
a bad game.
But it's not really a Mario game either.
Right.
But that's okay.
But now Mario's in everything, so a lot of things aren't, you know, Mario teaches typing. I mean, come on.
Yeah. I didn't know he was Mavis Beacon.
Yeah.
That was the first part of our two-part interview with Bobby Blackwolf, host of The Bobby Blackwolf Show. We hope you'll tune in for part two, where Bobby and I discuss the Atlanta game industry and the politics of the game industry, among other topics. You can listen to The Bobby Blackwolf Show at bobbyblackwolfshow.com. The song you're hearing in the background during bumpers is Acquiring on Impulse by Bobby Blackwolf. The song you heard in this podcast was Flux by Drop Trio, available only on Magnatune.com.
Thanks for listening to Mostly ITP on the Georgia Podcast Network. Visit us at gapodcastnetwork.com. If you have a question, comment, or drunken rant, leave us a voicemail by calling 678-389-9441. Who knows, it might be featured in a podcast. You can also email us at info@gapodcastnetwork.com.